Picture this. You're surrounded by about 1,700 teenagers sharing ideas and the latest scientific research on issues ranging from coding to cancer. The air is thick with competition, excitement, and nerves. This is the setting for Science Fair, the film that won the Sundance Institute's first ever Festival Favorite Award last month. Here's a bit from the trailer about the judging, the nerves, and what winning the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair would mean.
Today is the day to get it right. You know what I expect you to do. Just do it.
I threw up a little bit.
My vision was starting to get a little blurry, and then I fainted.
Everybody here has the potential to change the world. It's just about how they spin it, and if they spin it well, anyone could win.
Winning will change your life in ways that you don't even comprehend.
We have the directors and producers of the documentary Science Fair with us now. Darren Foster is on the line. Darren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Christina Costantini is also with us, by the way, of Milwaukee. Christina, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having us.
Let's start. Darren, first of all, set the scene for us. Tell the story that is told in Science Fair.
Well, Science Fair follows 1,700 kids from around the world on their journey to the International Science and Engineering Fair, which is the Olympics of Science Fair. It's a big international competition. We followed 9 students from around the country and around the world on their journey, and it's a whole lot of fun.
And Christina, as I understand it, I haven't seen the full documentary myself, but we really get to know these kids on this amazing journey, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. So we have kids from some of the best high schools in the world, the Yankees of the Science Fair, and then we have kids from under-resourced school districts, from very poor towns, all over the world. So it's a real range, but they're all teenagers. So they're all quirky and funny, and some of them are a little weird. So it's a celebration. For me, it's a love letter to the science fair, which I did when I was in high school.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about this, Christina. You were a winner, a statewide winner of a science fair here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's right. When I was 14, I won the Badger State Science Fair in Madison, Wisconsin, and it totally changed my life. I had no idea that there was even an international fair that I could go to if I won, and when it totally opened the world up to me. And so, for me, this was a celebration of that world and the kids that are in it.
And we'll get into the science fair world a little more in a bit. But, Darren, I wanted to ask, this is pretty different than the projects the two of you have worked on in the past. You've tackled fentanyl addiction in a piece before, sex trafficking, I believe. This is a very different kind of documentary for you two.
Very different. I mean, Christina and I are investigative journalists by trade, and we've done mostly, TV documentaries that, explore some pretty dark places. But after a number of years of doing that, I was certainly ready for a break, and that's when Christina proposed this idea of the science fair to me, and I couldn't have been happier to try something different. And it was a really, really fun project to work on, and the kids were amazing, and there is hope in this world, which is a really nice thing to get to say after completing a piece.
And Christina, I think there's an easy stereotype that might pop into people's heads when they think of kids who are into science at high school level or even college level. What does it mean to get up close and meet students and meet them as people and not just a stereotype of the science kids?
Yeah, there is an archetype. There's a nerdy, very shut off kid that you think of when you think of a science fair nerd. But they're really they run the gamut, and they are just as diverse as teenagers around the world are. So we have some of those mega nerds in our piece, but we also have different kinds of kids who are doing really amazing, exciting work. I think volcanoes or potato guns when you think of science fair, but the level of research that is going on at the International Science and Engineering Fair is totally remarkable. And, one of our kids made a very inexpensive arsenic tester. Another one is doing groundbreaking work in artificial intelligence. They're really doing things that you wouldn't expect a teenager to be able to do.
And Darren, Christina, as she said, had that background with science fairs. What did you think when you first had this? Heard this idea of a documentary following science fair contestants?
Well, I had participated in science fairs.
Oh, you did too.
But I was more in the level of the volcanoes and you know, potato guns. That's what I went to. So for me, you know, it was a complete revelation that this whole other world existed, and you know, that Christina had competed in. And so on our first scouting trip in 2016 to ISEP, it was the first time I got to experience, and I was just blown away. And I was actually really inspired because, I mean, these kids are celebrated like rock stars at this event.
And Christina,
and it's a really nice thing to see science, you know, sort of celebrated in that way.
And Christina, talk about the value that you see in science fairs, both from your own background and then following it through the kids you followed here.
Yeah, you know, I think science fair is a great program for a lot of kids who don't fit in the traditional academic path. We have one student who's absolutely brilliant, but is failing. He was failing out of his math class when we met him. And then he went on to win his state science fair for his number theory project. And he loves math more than anybody I've ever met, but school didn't spark his curiosity. It didn't engage him. And so a science fair, I think, is great for independent learners. It's an amazing program for kids who don't excel in sports or other things that are very celebrated in the American school system. And so, you know, I think we profiled a number of these characters. It was true for me that science fair is what really got me interested in learning. And so it's sad to me that, you know, Oklahoma just cut their funding for their state science fair. The international fair just lost their principal funder. Siemens, another big competition, just pulled their funding. So it's interesting for us to be doing this project that celebrates science fair at a time when science fair itself seems to be losing popularity in the mainstream.
We're talking with Christina Costantini and Darren Foster. They're the directors of Science Fair. The film follows participants at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair, and it won the 2018 Sundance Festival Favorite Award last month. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in science fairs growing up, or do you work with them maybe as a teacher or organizer? How did it affect your life, the life of kids in your school? What did you learn from science fairs? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll hear more about the documentary Science Fair coming up. We are getting a behind-the-scenes look at Science Fair, the documentary that took home the Sundance Festival's first-ever Festival Favorite Award. Our guests are the directors, Christina Costantini and Darren Foster. Darren, let's talk about that award. They haven't done this before. This is a film that was the favorite from, right, the whole festival, not like one category. You were up against, like, all the stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. It blew our minds. We had no idea that we were even, you know, going to get into Sundance, let alone win the Festival Favorite Award, which is quite incredible. Yes, we were up against about 120 other films across all categories, and, you know, to get this honor was a real shock to us, and I still don't believe it.
So congratulations for that. That's a big deal. And Christina, when are we going to start being able to see the science fair around here?
Well, so right now we're doing the festival circuit. So we're going to be at South by Southwest in a few weeks, Portland next week. We'll be in Toronto for TIFF Kids. But I'm really hoping and really excited about a Milwaukee premiere or a Wisconsin premiere. So, if you know people at the Wisconsin Film Festival, we'd love to premiere there. So, it's hopefully soon, but we don't know yet. Sometime in October, I hope it will come to Milwaukee.
And Christina, you were talking earlier about kind of this moment in science fairs. You're seeing funding being cut in some places around the country, in states, and for these big international fairs. And this is a moment in science where people are concerned about public attitudes towards science, public support for science. What do you think about that as you're taking this film on the road?
Yeah, you know, we didn't really intend for this to be a political film in any way. For us, this was, you know, just a break from what we usually did, which was very sad and serious. But as we were making the movie, we kind of found ourselves in this
situation where a lot of the people at the center of our movie had found themselves in a difficult situation, scientists, Muslims, immigrants. And so we let our characters tell their stories of what it feels like to be a scientist during this time. And so we hope that there are, you know, people take away from this how important science is right now for these kids and for our world. But we also hope that it makes people laugh, and we hope that it makes it, that it's an enjoyable way of seeing the importance of science in our world.
And Darren, you're following these kids for months. They're great kids. They're doing this exciting stuff. Some of them are going to win. Some of them obviously are going to lose. Is it kind of heartbreaking and nail-biting to watch as they go through this process, whether they're going to win or lose?
Yeah, you try to, you know, as a journalist, we always try to remain impartial. But then, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, you spend so much time with these kids that it's impossible not to get invested in them and their stories. And so when it was awards time, Christine and I were just on the edge of our seats and biting our nails and, you know, really hoping for the best for all of these kids. But, you know, just to get to ISF is such a huge accomplishment. It is so hard to get there. And then to win at ISF is just a whole nother game. So definitely, you know, we were... you know, sad for characters who were sad, but we were also really happy for our characters who did well. But for the most part, most people were just really happy to have that experience. So it was a win-win.
And Christina, I mean, for every older generation, there's the worry about kids today and how they're falling short and what's wrong with them. It goes back thousands of years, probably. You spent a lot of time with an interesting group of the kids today. What are your thoughts after this experience?
I would say the future is bright. I mean, the kids we follow at a time when a lot of the adults seem to be acting like children in our world, these children seem to be acting much more like adults. And so, you know, I think if these are our future leaders, I think we'll be okay.
And Christina, as someone who made this movie and as a past Badger Science Fair winner, can you share some maybe inspiration for kids listening, teachers, parents listening about participating in a future science fair?
Yeah, you know, I would say even if you don't think you're interested in science, I would give it a try because I did social science, which is, you know, the softer of the sciences. But it really, getting to the international fair and meeting 2,000 kids from around the world, it changes your life, and it is an incredible experience. And I think Science Fair teaches you a lot of things that have nothing to do with science. I credit it with a lot of who I've become. And so, you know, there could not be a bigger fan of Science Fair than me. So.
Well, hope to see your movie coming to Wisconsin. Christina and Darren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Darren Foster and Milwaukee's own Christina Costantini. They directed and produced the documentary Science Fair. The film won the first ever Festival Favorite Award at Sundance last month. We learned yesterday that one of the most influential and well-known religious figures in modern American history passed away this week at the age of 99. Reverend Billy Graham's evangelism, whether in person or over the airwaves, captivated millions and launched him to celebrity status and made him a confidant of presidents from both parties for decades. Here's Graham speaking to a live audience back in 1957.
More people stay out of the kingdom of God because of pride than any other sin. It's a humbling thing to come to the foot of the cross and repent of your sins and receive Christ. But I tell you, no man shall enter the kingdom of heaven unless he comes. There must be a self-emptying. There must be a self-crucifixion. There must be a repenting of sin. There must be receiving Christ who died on the cross for our sins.
Bill Leonard is chair of Baptist Studies and professor of church history at the Wake Forest University's School of Divinity. He studies American church history, and he's closely followed Graham's career. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Delighted. Thank you.
Bill, can you start by just talking about the scope of Reverend Billy Graham's career and what he meant for religion in America?
Graham really draws on a revivalistic tradition that runs from the First Great Awakening with Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield through camp meetings on the American frontier to what was called urban evangelism with Dwight Lyman Moody in Chicago in the mid-19th century and even into the 20th century with popular revivalists like Billy Sunday. But Graham takes that to another level, in part because of his own abilities as an evangelist who can address these massive crowds, but also because of his insightful use of 20th century technology. Many of these early evangelists preached their voices away because they had no public address system. Graham utilizes the technology in a way that literally gives him voice for all of these years. And he's a pioneer in revivalism and radio and revivalism, and then into television, and then for a time the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association produced its own movies. So he really comes into the post-war era with new methods and insights into an old revivalistic tradition.
What did he mean for the way American people, especially Baptists, experienced and practiced religion?
Graham, as an evangelical, is a person who stresses, and your recording illustrated it from very early in his career, who stresses a direct personal experience with Jesus, the experience of what the old revivalists call conversion or being born again. And for Graham, every person has the potential to choose Christianity, but has to do that willingly. And so he's very engaged in a kind of religious experience that becomes a transforming experience in the life of individuals who choose to follow it.
And this goes back to a Protestant tradition, and it seems like especially American tradition. Let's not get bogged down in the finer points of philosophy and theology. Sure. The important thing is that personal experience and that personal contact.
Yes, Protestants, particularly Puritans in the colonial period, made conversion, made this religious experience normative for the first time in Christian history. Conversion had been a part of Christianity since the beginning, but not necessarily as a normative requirement for all who would claim membership in the church. Graham extends that policy, that idea, in terms of mass evangelism.
How did Reverend Billy Graham end up being a confidant to presidents for literally decades and presidents of both parties?
I think in part because he was so publicly popular. Let's begin by saying he really is the great Protestant national chaplain. No one before or since has really shaped and drawn that collective identity for Protestantism in America. And because of his popularity, he is sought out by politicians and public figures from Hollywood to Washington. And then there's a sense in which Graham himself sought them out, as he will later acknowledge, because of the difficulties that developed with his friendship with Richard Nixon. So there's a sense in which, from Truman to Trump, political officials, particularly presidents and presidential candidates, have a meeting with Billy Graham to get some sort of at least communication, if not imprimatur, from him.
Now, back in the 80s, it seems like there was a string of scandals involving some high-profile Christian figures, people we saw all the time on TV in particular. Billy Graham, Reverend Graham, for the most part, avoided being dragged into that, didn't he?
Yes, from early in his ministry, the 1940s, Graham is very concerned about the integrity of his office as an evangelist. And that's part of the reason why he sets up the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, to put in place a mechanism for monitoring particularly the finances that are drawn. He puts himself on a salary from the association to be sure that all of his dealings financially and in terms of the corporate nature of his work would be above board. And that carried him, I think, as a in some ways a unique person in that period when so many public evangelists, television evangelists, were being found to be corrupt, particularly financially or in some form or another.
Bill Leonard is with us from the Wake Forest University School of Divinity, looking at the life and legacy of Reverend Billy Graham, who passed away earlier this week. I want to get into a couple points of controversy as people look back at his career, Bill. One involves segregation and the civil rights movement. I've seen arguments kind of across the spectrum as to where he fell in that. It seems like it was a mixed bag in conclusion. What do you think?
I think you're correct there. Early on, he moves to desegregate his campaigns, his crusades, particularly, as you'd expect, in the South. In many cases, himself removing the ropes that divided the white section from the section for people of color in his campaigns. And in that way, he was a trailblazer in terms of evangelistic gatherings in the South. But there's also a sense in which Graham himself later on acknowledged, particularly after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that he wished he had been more directly involved in the protests of the civil rights movement. And so there was this early effort at desegregation, but then a hesitancy to involve himself in the more, shall we say, radical public protests of radical for those days in terms of direct engagement in the movement that King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference developed.
And then Reverend Billy Graham was a voice, maybe not the leading voice of the country, but against the idea of same-sex marriage. Can you talk about his legacy in that issue?
I think it's important to go back and say that when Graham begins, the controversial marriage issue in this country among Protestants was divorce. And Graham came out in significant opposition to divorce as dividing and splitting families in the post-World War II generation. And in a sense, that solidifies his sense of a particular biblical way of understanding the nature of marriage. I don't think Graham was necessarily opposed to remarriage, but I think he was very hesitant about it because of what Jesus says about the remarriage of divorced persons in Matthew's gospel. That carries into his I think, opposition to same-sex marriage and a variety of LGBT issues that came to the public square. In that sense, he remains a controversial, a traditionalist in confronting those public issues, yes.
And Bill, Reverend Billy Graham was a Baptist, but it seems like he had a very strong interdenominational appeal among American Protestants. Did he help kind of blur the denominational lines that maybe used to be stronger?
He attempted to do that. Yes, he's reared in a Presbyterian family, has a longtime membership in First Baptist Church of Dallas. But and I'm glad you raised this issue because early on, he, in many ways, is in controversy with rabid fundamentalist hard right evangelicals who are opposed to the fact that he admits Roman Catholic bishops, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Methodist ministers whom they consider to be liberal, to participate on the platform with him as his crusades. Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, wrote him off very early because he extended that invitation to persons they thought were unorthodox and outside the realm of fundamentalist dogma. And there's a sense in which he's also a part of the early stages of what becomes the ecumenical movement in the late 50s and into the 60s. What has happened? Also, Graham is, in many sense, senses an inventor, a shaper of what was the neo-evangelical movement as an effort to move away from the old stereotypes of fundamentalism. However, he lived to see evangelicalism in itself divided between the extreme religious right that has in many ways captivated evangelicalism in the present day, and both ecumenical and interfaith dialogue among the denominations.
Such a unique role in American religion. Is there a place for a new Billy Graham now?
In the 1980s, a number of us, I'm one, when Graham was moving toward, quote, retirement age, wrote articles, Who Will Be the Next Billy Graham? In 1980s, I wrote an article for the Christian Century for that and said then, as I think now, there will not be another. There may be a variety of Billy Grahams who represent a kind of public presence and identity for subgroups or silos of religious communities in the country. But no one has arisen really before or after who becomes the national Protestant chaplain in the way that Billy Graham personified. And the evangelicalism and Protestantism in general in this country is so siloed that there's really not a place for a central figure as Graham came to be.
It's a good place to leave it. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your conversation.
That's Bill Leonard, Chair of Baptist Studies and Professor of Church History at the Wake Forest University School of Divinity. He joined us to talk about the life and legacy of the Reverend Billy Graham, who passed away this week at the age of 99.